Good morning. It's about 3 o'clock, according to me, 3 a.m. Actually, today is a day that we're supposed to have a bit of a bludge in Australia because it's Melbourne Cup Day. So, anybody who wants to gamble on whether I stay awake for the presentation, I'll take bets on that. I'd like to thank Cecil and the committee for inviting me to give the talk. In fact, Graham Hammer or myself would have both been happy, but seeing as I was already here, Graham suggested I give the talk. And I'd like to really acknowledge the co-authors there from CSIRO, Bob, Sav, Dave and Bernie. This is really just a think-through sort of talk, a little bit like what Jeff had done, and in fact Jeff and Steve have covered a lot of my points, so thanks very much for that. Just a little bit of background of where we come from the modelling side of things. A lot of our work for the last 20 years, we've been interested in gene to phenotype prediction, so we're trying to predict at the crop level, and we sort of stretch back into plant and organ level. We don't go back to cell level, although we may incorporate cell function in some of our parameters in our crop models. Australian environments are just all about water productivity, so a lot of our focus is on how plants grow leaf area and roots and how they use water across the season. So it's really important to remember that. It's one of the reasons why modelling has been a successful activity in Australia, because we're water limited, so it makes it a lot easier to run the model. I mean, when you're in really high yielding environments and your limits are nutrition, it's actually a lot more difficult to model. So this is an example for sorghum, where we're trying to look at water demand as functions of maturity, tillering, leaf transpiration rate and management. In fact, tomorrow I've got to give a talk in a symposium that Mitch Tynstra's organised in genetics. I'll be talking a lot more about this stuff tomorrow. But this is a sorghum crop with lots of soil in between it in a double skip system. So a physiologist from a well-watered part of the world would suggest that this plant, this crop, is wasting huge amounts of light, and indeed it is. But there are roots under there, and there are roots with narrow angles that will actually explore that way. So the genetics is set up to work with that cropping system. So we're trying to work out how to match water demand and supply and how to get the timing right. And we're interested in using phenotypic technologies or phenotyping technologies to help with that. I think you've probably seen this, and you might see it once or twice during the various symposiums, that we're using the APSIM model to capture information about phenomics, and I'll get to some summary points on that at the end that Jeff brought up. I won't go into details about it. But the main areas from the point of view of water demand and supply we're trying to deal with are in this part of the physiological determinants. So if you think of grain yield being formed from relationships that determine grain number, grain size, we're mainly looking in this talk at the processes around biomass production, which are related in APSIM. We have a switching model that either switches from transpiration driven or radiation driven. So if a crop has a certain amount of radiation hitting it on a certain day, it'll be trying to match that with a given transpiration efficiency. It'll be trying to demand a certain amount of transpiration, and if the roots don't have it, then water is running the show for the day. So this is a slide that Xavier Sirois put together, summarising his version of phenotype. And his interests are in trying to translate data from plant level information in controlled environments and using that to be very complementary to the field environments. And again, both Jeff and Steve have already mentioned that, and I think some other people will. We're quite often interested in these plant level environments to understand fundamental parameters of how plants grow, but we want to be able to predict in a crop environment. And I'll talk a bit about some of the choices of those things as we go. So the two areas that we're interested in thinking about how to model traits for water productivity are in what we use the models as a way of organising our physiological understanding. We have to think about the input traits, the canopy, the root system, and the integrated traits, so the relationship between the transpiration efficiency and the radiation use efficiency and how that balance might work out. If we can't actually articulate a trait into our model, then we need to justify measuring it. And so somebody asked a bit earlier about how do you know when you should phenotype a trait or not. The way that we think about it is if we can't fit it into the model of the physiology of how plants work, then we probably wouldn't measure it. We've got to have a reason for expecting that it will have a certain influence in our environments. And that might have an influence in our environments that doesn't occur in particularly in well-watered environments. And then I'll mention a bit about the output traits at the end. So to give a bit of an overview of some of the plant platforms that we're using, these are ones based at the High Resolution Plant Phenomics Centre in Canberra, which is a national facility in Australia. It's a combination of the ANU, CSIRO and the University of South Australia. University of Adelaide. And Xavier is mainly responsible for this. So he's built a very nice system to do high resolution mapping of leaf area in a nice pipeline. And this is all done through the, you know, supercomputer kind of stuff that Steve was mentioning. But the pipeline's been built with some help from some of our image analysis friends who actually work in biomedical imaging. So it made a change from trying to work out how to visualise livers and brains to understand plants. But they decided that was actually a bit easier than doing brains. So they were quite happy to help us. And Zab's working a fair bit with CIRAD and INRA in fusing this data with mathematical models to structure the canopy. So, and I think there are many examples of doing this in the literature now, of being able to extract the information about each leaf on a plant and to be able to articulate the reflectance characteristics of the plant. And again, this is something that will come in when you're thinking about what Steve was saying, trying to calculate indices from these. The nice thing is that with this kind of system, we've got hyperspectral imaging at the same time as we've got the LiDAR type imaging to build the leaf area. So this is a good place to try and understand how to build those relationships that for prediction that we then might be able to use in the field. So this is a Croppatron gantry, a custom built one that we built for Erie as part of the project, and it carries a bunch of equipment on there. I won't go into that. The other main platform that's used is one at the University of Queensland, the LPAD, the Lysimetry platform. So this is a platform of large pots on whey cells, on load cells, that let us measure water use with a high degree of precision and relate that to the VPD changes in this greenhouse. The other area where there's been quite a bit of work in the sorghum and wheat areas at UQ is in looking at root angle, and I already mentioned earlier one of the reasons why we're interested in root angle in sorghum in particular, to try to characterise how different sorghum genotypes can fit into different management systems. So this is a summary of some of the field phenomics work that's been done, and I'll go through a couple of these bits and pieces. The first is this static wireless network. I've actually got to talk something about this afternoon in Matthew's session a couple of people are in. But this has been implemented in a series of field sites around Australia, the managed environment facilities, the three major sites, where mostly wheat program but also canola are running experimentation that's on a shared site. So anybody can use the site in the research environment in Australia. And it's all instrumented up to have monitoring of soil water in key plots, weather, and using these, what they call ArduCrop, because they were built on Arduino systems. These are infrared thermometry networks, wireless networks. In fact, this is This is version 1, they call it. I had version 0.5, which I must say was a little bit challenging because the batteries kept running out. And I said, why don't you solar power it? So you can see that I got my wish. These are the ones that I was using this year. And in fact, we've got an even simpler one now. I think we can get the component prices of these things are down to around $50 to $100. But of course, you've got to have a bit of labour to put them together. And what we're trying to do is build an open source version of this system and deliver that. So this is a close-up of one of these. You can go and have a look at SensorDB yourselves. You'll probably be able to access bunches of our data sets that are not protected. There are some of them that are password protected. But the types of information that you can track in there are things like this deviation from hourly mean of canopy temperature. So these are a set of wheat genotypes over about a week. And this is the deviation from the mean of the trial. So you can see that some of these genotypes are getting quite a bit hotter than some of the others. This is a similar data, but just for a temporal scale. This is the Phenomobile Light. So the first machine that they built was, they never called it the Phenomobile Heavy, but it was. It was a golf buggy on steroids, because they took a golf buggy and thought this will make a good Phenomobile because it's cheaper than a spray coupe. But by the time you jacked up the golf buggy and put a bunch of Dell servers on it and a few other bits and pieces, it became very heavy. And so this is the Phenomobile Light, which you can build for about $20,000, excluding the equipment. But it's got a motorized wheel here and a steering system at the back of it. So it's part of the CSIRO fitness program. Bernie told me, that's not Bernie, but Bernie, oh yes it is, that's Jose Jimenez Bernie. So Bernie told me he did 16 kilometres the other day in about 32 degrees, and I said, well, don't tell the OH&S people that. But you can see he's got sunglasses and a hat, so he's happy. But it's got a green seeker, an RGB camera, and a high quality LiDAR on there. And also, it often carries a ASD spectral system. So this is the pipeline that they're building for this, which is called the Data Barn. So it allows us to extract the LiDAR information. And this is some information, for example, of leaf area profiles and wheat isolines. So these are the height profiles and the amount of leaf area that's come from this extraction from the LiDAR. These are height isolines of wheat, so they're meant to differ in height. Some of the other areas of work that have been used for this are in thermal imagery. These guys like to use a real helicopter. I use a remotely piloted aircraft, as we have to call them now. We're not supposed to call them UAVs anymore. But we've just published some work on that, using it for crop cover, diurnal change in canopy temperature, and estimating 3D lodging. So again, using the technologies that Steve mentioned from aerial photos, using them as stereo photogrammetry, you can calculate lodging in each of the plots in the field. I haven't got time to go into that here. All of this information goes into a data warehouse, and again, we're opening this up, and we're going to be encouraging other people to use it if they want, as a storage system for mainly for research, but also for collaborators with us who work on commercial projects. This structured system allows us to store all of the data together and try to process it together. And this was the last slide I wanted to mention on these technologies, and really it's a summary of the points that Steve was making as well. There's been some very nice work done in the various remote sensing journals on how to try to use leaf characteristics, leaf angle, to deal with reflectance and use these sail models where you're trying to estimate reflectances based on a distribution of leaves. And what you really want to do is, rather than do this from some kind of distribution of angles or distribution of surface positioning, is actually take the LiDAR data that we're collecting and use the exact positioning to improve the reflectance estimation. but we think that we should be able to validate some of these types of things. This is actually for poplar. But we should be able to validate some of these types of things in our plant scanning equipment and then test them in the field, which is where we're heading with that. So to come back to the points before, where do we use input and output traits, or how do we plug these into our models? And I guess from the technologies that I've just been discussing, from the leaf canopy side of it, the technologies that we're using in the field and glasshouse now, we think we can pick up all of these different traits from the analyses. I think one of the ones that we're particularly interested in is a structural distribution of nitrogen and the effect on radiation use efficiency, because there's a lot of interest in being able to describe a wheat canopy or a sorghum canopy in great detail because of the light interception. But in the case of wheat, from long experience of research, it seems that a lot of the tillering that goes on in wheat isn't necessarily about accumulating radiation, it's about accumulating nitrogen before it gets washed out of the soil. So what we're trying to understand is, how can we estimate that nitrogen distribution? What does that impact have on RUE, and what does the recycling of that nitrogen, or what effect does that have on the RUE? I think I explained earlier the reason why we're interested in the root system, changing root angle and proliferation of roots. And then we're interested in these integrated traits, and as I just mentioned, radiation use efficiency. How does specific leaf nitrogen relate to that? How does it change with the light environment in the canopies? Transpiration efficiency, how does that relate to VPD in particular, and how do we build better models of that? Again, I've got to talk about some of that later this afternoon. It's quite difficult, even with that lysimetry platform, to really infer whether the transpiration efficiency that you're seeing is mediated by the roots, the leaves, or the stems, or some combination of those. Your immediate thought is it's mostly to do with stomatal control, which it is, but is it really the stomata doing the work, or is it stem resistance or root resistance or something else? So one of the areas for this community in agroclimatology and modelling, and in fact we talked about it at an AgMet wheat meeting in France a few months ago, is canopy temperature. If we ever needed the physical modellers to get better engaged with us again, it really is to get this canopy temperature modelling sorted out. And James made a good case for that yesterday in cotton. I think there'd be a lot of value in being able to do a much better job of modelling temperature effects, because we'll be able to make much better use of these technologies to do that. I guess I sort of mentioned a couple of those things here. I called it reverse modelling. I think Jeff likes to call it inverse modelling, but he's not here, so I can say reverse modelling. But I sort of gave you the example of canopy area and nitrogen dynamics, trying to run the model backwards and estimate the canopy dynamics through a grid search. I did mention to Robert a bit earlier today that, yes, you can spend a lot of time trying to optimise these grid searches. CSIRO's got about 10,000 processes online across our network, so I use everybody's desktop while they're having lunch, and we're able to do very big simulations of absolute, and in fact, it's way better than any of our clusters, because being able to run across all of those desktop processes has been very efficient for us. It's by far the fastest way for us to run massive runs with AppSim. If you try to get on the cluster queue, it might have 1,000 processes in it, but it's also in CSIRO, it's got a whole bunch of astrophysicists in the queue, and they get ahead of you rather than the crop modelers always get second shot. So we've found that the Condor system has been fantastic for that. In the crop water use and water use efficiency, as I mentioned, we really want to be able to work out, we're able to get dense information on canopy temperature over time, and also on the change in weather within the field over time. And we're really keen to try and work out how to make better use of that information. And eventually to try to model the water use patterns, because I can guarantee that nobody who works with me in the field is going to be interested in putting a neutron tube in 3,000 plots. Even though in our soils we know the neutron tube is by far the best way of measuring the water uptake. If you're in a vertisol, there's no other technology that can do it. So with that, I'd like to just thank my co-workers and also to acknowledge a few other staff in CSIRO and UQ whose work I mentioned in the talk. And thanks for your attention.
Thank you, Scott. Are there any questions for Scott? We have time, actually. Unfortunately, the next presentation was canceled because the speakers will come. But we have a lot of time for discussion.
Yeah, maybe we should invite Steve up as well.
Yeah,
is that all right?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Do you want to chair this?
So Scott, if you only measure what you know you can fit into your models, how do we make advances in science if you're only measuring what you know?
Are we?
We'll put it in the model. It's more, we'd like to know whether we can frame it in our models, I suppose.
Let's say we do gene expression work and we look at genes that are doing these sorts of things in response. And we're looking at gene expression, how do you get that into your model?
Well, I'm not usually interested in gene expression. If I can't get it up to a trait level, then I probably
don't. Gene expression says between these two plants, in response to water stress, it's down-regulating all the photosynthetic capacity and it's down-regulating the ability to utilize nutrients.
Yep.
How do we integrate that into your model?
Well, it's a fair question, but it's also an unfair question. I think that Steve can answer. I'll come back.
So actually, Jeff is the one that should be answering this because he did some of the original work that I think led to the idea, but he's not here, so I'll do my best. So some of Jeff's early work with Common Bean is that he knew some genotypes, and he basically regressed the crop coefficients that he estimated on genotype and was able for certain genotype or for certain traits to really improve the prospect in his crop model. Now, more recently, the idea has been that what we need to do is to fit the models, do QTL analysis, or in other words, find the genes and then use those to tell us what the crop coefficients should be. The problems that's shaping up with that, and I don't want to steal Kelly's thunder, but this equifinality issue is a serious one in terms of estimating crop. But fortunately, in the last 10 years, our abilities to come up with candidate genes from a variety of different methods has tremendously improved. Everything from EQTL analysis to, some of the things that I showed where you're mapping measurements directly and so forth. And so I think what's going to happen is that there'll be sort of a revival of the idea that Jeff initially developed, but now what we'll be able to do is by using the candidates and so forth get a good idea of which terms to put in those equations that relate genotype to what the crop coefficients are.
Yeah, just to add to that briefly, I mean, all of those traits that I mentioned right at the start, we've actually mapped those in sorghum. Basically, these things here you can think of as traits: maturity, tillering, leaf transpiration rate, surrogate is transpiration efficiency in that case, and root exploration. So I guess I wouldn't really consider gene expression as a trait, I suppose, is probably my short answer.
It's arguable.
it does indirectly. When I said we were putting traits in that way, we've measured traits at a resolution where we see variation amongst germplasm in the field. So that might be the transpiration efficiency at the leaf level, and then we'll look for QTL information associated with that, and not necessarily gene information. But with sorghum, we've done that very well. We've done the same thing that Jeff did with flowering time. We've done that in both sorghum and wheat. So relating gene effects to parameters that are controlling either temperature or photoperiod response in the case of sorghum. Sorry.
Any other questions?
Oh, sorry.
Are you measuring, in your presentation you mentioned the LAI, are you measuring LAI in the field, and so how?
With the LIDAR.
With the LIDAR?
Yeah.
So is it mostly productive in each area, or are you really getting to the canopy underneath, like a crop like that, where you have multiple layers?
You can get it to... It depends on how much penetration you can get, of course. I guess you can build it up over time, so if you monitor it over time, you can get a better idea. I think Ken had a question.
Yeah, hi, Scott. So, I was interested in the integrated print, and the picture, the radiation use efficiency versus specifically nitrogen. And my question is it good enough to look at that to understand even the impact of vertical distribution of nitrogen light efficiency? When you really look, you're really confounding two things. You're confounding net assimilation in relation to leaf nitrogen and respiration in respect to leaf nitrogen. Now, if you look at the data on the two, the literature is very rich with leaf nitrogen and net assimilation, whereas really sparse is respiration and leaf nitrogen. Often 3 points, 20 degrees, 30, and 40. My question is this: in a world with rising temperatures, is it going to be good enough to look at it that way, where we're looking at radiation efficiency versus this confounded leaf nitrogen parameter?
It's about 10%, isn't it? Leaf respiration is a component of the total photosynthesis.
In terms of the height, I mean, the other argument is that we're going to have to be pushing yields much higher. Maybe crop value is double on existing land, which means canopies are just much chock fuller of nitrogen. So I guess, that's my question.
I could
understand that higher end of leaf nitrogen and respiration. Or is it something that's outside the boundaries of really where we've been looking?
Well, it's outside the boundaries of where I'm looking, because you know what my environment's like. We're never going to be working at that level, so it's a bit difficult for me to answer because I don't work at those 12-ton levels or whatever. I work at 3 tons.
But wheat growers in Australia, there are favorable environments.
There are some, yep. And in fact, you can get 12 tons of wheat in Australia. So one way of starting to get at that is actually this one. So this is the reflectance from the LIDAR data, so process per plot. And in fact, we can use the intensity because it's actually a red LIDAR. It's a surrogate for the nitrogen content, so you can actually colour this to get an estimate of the nitrogen as well. So that's one shortcut. So I think we can measure it, whether we're modelling the consequences of it very well. Well, we're certainly not. I mean, we don't try to model the respiration effects of nitrogen specifically, or increased nitrogen in our models. But yes, it may well be of greater value, particularly in the US environment, and certainly under warmer environments, absolutely.
Could you explain that a little bit more? Are these vertical canopy profiles?
Taken from the LIDAR data. So all of the points in a single plot or in this, these are actually plot data, not genotype data, but all the data in a single plot has been, we've estimated the average return by depth. So.
And this is looking from above?
Yeah, just
from
the... Yeah, but with a high quality. It's an LMS 400 SICK LIDAR. It's a very high-res LIDAR.
So you're probably getting multiple bounces.
You do need to get some ground in the picture. Shame.
So, Scott, the last time they let me in your country, I didn't speak to a human being going through. I simply showed up and they assessed me as not a threat, probably not very effective. But they let me in very quickly, right? Just look at my face.
Was that a computer or a person?
It was a computer.
Oh,
yeah,
on your passport.
You may want to talk with them about that.
So I always talk to
them. My question is, as we look at the kind of data we've seen today, can we ultimately begin to reduce these sort of patterns, canopy temperature, LIDAR, whatever you call it, into just simple patterns that go, that's a friendly face, that's a threatening face, right? and so that we're not having to look at, you know, they take a picture of me, but they probably use 3 points off of my face to let me in or not. We're taking all this data, and I'm a big believer in detailed data, sucking it all in. But is our goal ultimately to break it into just crude categories initially, or do we have to stay at the fine scale the whole time?
I think it depends on what's a useful phenotype, and our interest is mainly with breeding, so it depends on what's a useful phenotype for a breeder. A useful phenotype for a breeder is something that discriminates them for the trait, and one that can be ultimately delivering the product, which is yield or quality or whatever it is. So it's not at all necessary to model yield. And this is one of the things that the modelling community needs to keep in mind too, is that I talk mostly about biomass today, and it's a lot easier to model biomass than it is to model yield, because a whole lot of things go wrong when we try to partition yield. It's the biggest failing in our models. But a lot of this information can be particularly useful in earlier parts of the selection process, where you're trying to find materials that use water in an optimal fashion, or light in an optimal fashion, or nitrogen in an optimal fashion. And you might use those characteristics to evaluate materials, make crosses, and then you'll still go through your phenotyping for yield. I mean, we're never going to replace a harvester with these things, and we never intend to. But yeah, the data reduction steps are important to us, and the LIDAR is all about data reduction, and we're still working on that pipeline. It's not clean yet, but it's been reduced down to things like this from thousands of data points per plot. But whether this is this is an example, really. I mean, you could probably read some faces into those if you want to, but maybe you shouldn't. So I could think we could use them like that, or we can process them a bit further to a more physiologically.
I'd like to add to that, because there's another argument that goes in the same direction. We were talking a few minutes ago about this problem of equivalency when you're trying to fit complex models, and as I said, there's a lot of techniques that are available to identify candidate genes. Well, one way to do that is to fit very simple models where that equivalency issue is not so great, identify the QTL, and then go from there, and I think that simplification is going in the direction that what you're saying as well. And so I think, yeah, there's great merit for looking, you know, not necessarily completely focusing on, you know, the high-end eco-physiological models.
Any other questions? I have a question. I want to direct it for all three presenters this morning. Did you have the modelers or the modeling scenarios in mind in all this design of these experiments?
Do we?
Yeah.
Yes. I guess a lot of what we're trying to do is measure component traits that have a rational place to live in our models, I suppose, is that. The models aren't always part of the pipeline, though. So we're trying to make it the case in the different crops, but they're sort of models fit in different ways in this pipeline. Sometimes they're more obvious than others. But
I'd say in response to that, yes, we did, because you have to have some rational place to start. But some of the most interesting things we're finding are things that we hadn't thought of originally, and yet that open opportunities for us. So.